Bluegrass Jam Along is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, each and every one built from the sound up in Austin, Texas. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of roots music instruction. If you want to improve your playing, join me and thousands of other pickers getting better every day at pegheadnation.com. Hi, this is Matt. You're listening to Bluegrass Jam Along, the podcast for anyone and everyone who loves bluegrass. Hey everybody, welcome back. This is part 3 of the Earl Scruggs 100th birthday tribute. If you missed part 1 and 2, go back and check those out. They are full of really cool interviews with Jerry Douglas, Tim O'Brien, Tony Trischka, plenty more people. But this is part 3, and I thought we'd do something slightly different for this one. I've talked to lots of people already, but I thought it'd be interesting to explore a couple of other areas of Earl's influence, including his guitar playing and his impact on some younger players as well. So we're going to kick this off with Trey Hensley, who's going to chat a bit about meeting and playing with Earl when he was a kid and what sort of influence Earl's been on him, specifically his guitar playing. And I'm a big fan of Earl's guitar playing, so that's it was a treat for me. I'm also going to talk to Kyle Tuttle. Now, Kyle is the banjo player in Molly Tuttle's band Golden Highway. And I spoke to Kyle because he's got a new album coming out, and that's going to be out in a couple of weeks, a full interview with Kyle. But I took the opportunity to chat to him about Earl's influence on him. And he's, you know, this the record he's got coming out is pretty progressive. There's some electric banjo on there, a lot of treated stuff. And I thought it'd be interesting to talk to him about how Earl's influence sort of comes through in more of a jam band world as well. And then I talked to Willow Osborne, and Willow started playing banjo when she was 4. And Earl was a massive influence on her, and she's also sort of talks about how Earl is an influence on the young players she sees coming through. So it's just nice to explore and celebrate that sort of legacy as well. So we're going to kick off with Trey Hensley, who I've talked to several times before for this podcast. Always a treat. And Trey's going to chat about Earl's influence on him, sort of the part he played in his early career, and also Earl's guitar playing. So here is Trey Hensley.
Yeah, I mean, that stuff was kind of what made me want to play music. You know, I heard, I think there was something particularly, you know, something about bluegrass, and that was really my introduction to bluegrass was Flat and Scruggs. My granddad had just a big record collection, but mostly country. So a lot of Hank, you know, and Merle Haggard and George Jones and that kind of stuff. But he had 5 or 6 Flat and Scruggs records. And he didn't have the Carter Family record, I don't think. But he had one that had Earl playing You Are My Flower on it. And I remember hearing that. And I remember hearing Jimmy Brown, the Newsboy. And those were two that were just biggies. And so when I started playing guitar, it was because of seeing, you know, Charlie Waller and Jimmy Martin at a festival, but I still had Flat and Scruggs kind of on the brain. And so I went to a local record shop, CD store, and I went in to buy a Flat and Scruggs CD. Cause you know, I'd gone to Best Buy and Circuit City when those were a thing. And they just look at you like you're, you know, just insane for even thinking that they would have Flat and Scruggs. And so I went to the local CD store and they came in, you know, and had basically everything. So it was kind of overwhelming. And I loved the Flat and Scruggs Carter Family album cover. And it's, if you've ever seen it, it's two paintings and painting of Lester, painting of Earl. They're both green. And it's just something about that CD just really, really spoke to me. So I got that, and I got at Carnegie Hall because it had 32 songs on it. And I was like, okay, I'm going to get my money's worth. And so I think I listened to the Carnegie Hall record first. And I've listened to that one so many times over the years. I mean, I always tell people I know exactly when the cowbell is going to come in, and I can hear all this stuff without even listening to that CD. I can hear it, you know. And but that Carter Family record was one that when I really dove into it, it was like everything on here I want to learn. I want to learn how to play it. And that was my main goal. You know, I wanted to learn Carter's Blues and or I guess it's Forsaken Love on there. But all these great Carter Family tunes that Earl played. Mm. And so his guitar playing was really inspirational for me. And I mean, he played on that Carnegie Hall record too. He played Wildwood Flower and Let the Church Roll On and, you know, a couple of those songs. And, of course, his banjo playing was, you know, secretly I wanted to be a banjo player. And, but I remember my dad said, we can't, you know, it's going to be hard to, because I wanted to sing too. And he's like, it's going to be hard to do both. You know, you can kind of accompany yourself better if you start on guitar at least. And then once I started, it was like, okay, I'm never doing anything else. But those Flat and Scruggs songs with Earl playing guitar, I still remember how they made me feel, you know, and I still feel it when I hear them. There's just these little nuanced things that, and he, of course, he played with his, you know, fingers, with finger picks like he would have playing the banjo. And there's so many just little things that the way he played that just really, it hits me really hard. And it, you know, I think it did everybody that heard it. But, you know, I think his guitar playing, he's such a great banjo player, and he created so much on that it could possibly get overlooked of how great a guitar player he was too.
Yeah, it's astonishing. Like some of those first Flat and Scruggs recordings, the kind of the gospel tunes, like Is It Going to Make Heaven My Home? And it's just like this such a distinctive sound. Like nobody else really plays a guitar like that.
It's just
as inventive in its own way.
Yeah, it's not Travis picking. It's not Chet Atkins stuff. It's a totally unique thing. And, you know, it's a lot of it is the fact that he played banjo. It's a lot of those roles, you know, especially on that, the Paul and Silas and going to make heaven my home and all those gospel tunes. It was definitely inspired probably by Merle Travis, but it had its own thing, you know, and his tone was always so good. And I love, you know, now we get to see all those Martha White shows. And, you know, just to get to see Earl put that guitar up next to his ear and take a guitar solo, it's just, that's the best stuff on YouTube.
Yeah, I remember it was a three pickers thing was the first time it sort of occurred to me that Earl was playing guitar. Because, like, you know, you sit watching it and there's Earl with a guitar. Like, I could have listened to that and maybe not realized, but, and it just hadn't occurred to me. And then once you've heard it and you've heard that sound, like, you can always hear an Earl Scruggs guitar part.
Yeah, you can pick it out. And like I said, it is a totally unique tone. The way, you know, his index finger hits his thumb with the picks makes a sound. And it's like all this stuff that just you can really geek out about it. I mean, I have for years. And, you know, I got to play with him when I was a kid. And I remember getting a set of finger picks after that because he had showed me a couple things. The way he played them, it's like, okay, well, I got to do this, and I could just never get that sound. And so, you know, cue to all the millions of banjo players thinking the same thing with Earl. You know, it's like I just can't get that sound because it was him. But yeah, it was a totally, totally unique thing. I mean, I was just listening to the that Marty Stewart album, The Pilgrim, recently, and you know, Earl plays "You Are My Flower" in the middle of one of those songs, and you know, that would have been whatever year that was recorded, 99 or 2000, you know, 50 years after Flat and Scruggs had done it the first time. And the first note, like the very first note that you hear Earl come in, you could tell it a mile away, that's Earl Scruggs. And it's, you know, same with banjo. He had his own sound.
And you sort of joke about it, but that's what everybody has said, is, you know, that you can pick apart the notes and you can learn where he's putting his fingers, but like Earl has a sound that only Earl has ever made. And it's like, I guess it's, you know, it's the theme with all of these great musicians we talk about, whether it's Clarence White or Tony Rice or anybody, it's that's the bit that nobody else is going to touch, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I was just thinking, I mean, how many times I've said that about Tony, you know, how many people play those licks, but it ain't there, you know, it's just missing that. And it's, you know, that's like with Earl. I wanted to learn all those songs. I wanted to learn the way he played them. And it's, you know, took me a long time to realize that you can learn the notes, but everything that you hear is just him. You know, it's just him. It's just the way he played. And he, you know, just getting to talk with him a little bit about it, you know, he was just so influenced by Maybelle. And it was, you know, it would just talk about, you know, he didn't think Maybelle could be touching. I mean, she couldn't. She was just the, you know, top if it all kind of goes back to her. And, but you know, when they did that record, he was talking about just being intimidated by her playing auto harp on the album, because that's what she did on that record. You know, she played all the auto harp and Earl played her guitar parts. And, so it's a cool record, you know, it was a cool one for looking back on it. It was a good one. You know, I feel like I can credit that record in a lot of ways for, you know, me wanting to continue doing what I'm doing. And, it was a big one to start on.
And I remember from when we talked previously, I interviewed you before, and you, I think the first time you played the Opry was with Earl, wasn't it? And he played quite a role in your early career.
Yeah. The first time I got to play, it was actually with Marty Stewart. And, so kind of a short, long story, but, when I met Marty, I had learned like four songs from that Carter Family album, that Earl Scruggs, Flat Scruggs, Carter Family album. And, the way, if you listen to those records, the way that Earl plays, songs like Jimmy Brown, the Newsboy, or, the way he plays, Storms on the Ocean or You Are My Flower, you pick up the little things he does, and it's a very particular thing. And it's kind of like mimicking the notes, especially on Jimmy Brown, the Newsboy. So kind of fast forwarding to when I met Marty, that was the first song I played for him backstage. And, I didn't really know it at the time. I knew Marty's history. I was a big Marty Stewart fan. I knew he played with Lester, but I didn't know that the first record he had was, I think it was like Fabulous Johnny Cash and The Greatest Hits of Flat Scruggs. And on that record, Earl played Jimmy Brown, the Newsboy. And so it was almost like it wasn't intentional. I didn't play it for that reason, but it was almost like Marty just immediately knew that, okay, here's somebody, you know, coming up long after I started that kind of cut from the same cloth or listened to the same stuff, you know? And so he picked up on the Earl influence. And so as a surprise to me, Marty had Earl come out and play with us the night that I played on the Opry. And as an additional surprise, they let me kind of, probably not to Earl, but to me, the surprise was to get to hang out with him before the Opry. And, but you know, I'm sure everybody you've interviewed that knew Earl said the same thing. It's like he was the nicest guy ever. Him and Louise were so great. And, you know, we did sound check at like 4:30 at the Opry, at the Ryman, and we didn't play until 7:30 or 8. And so that's a good 3 hour chunk of time that I kind of had Earl just to talk to and to ask questions. And, you know, it was my ultimate guitar hero. And he was so kind. And, you know, after that, anytime he played around East Tennessee or North Carolina or anywhere close to me, he would invite me out to come play. And that's where I met Rob Ikes the first time. And, you know, met a lot of people for the first time, Jerry and Stuart Duncan and a lot of folks. But it kind of all spawned from Earl.
We'll be right back with you just after this. We'll be right back with you just after this. Collings Guitars has been a long-time supporter of the bluegrass community, from collaborating with artists to sponsoring festivals big and small, and now by sponsoring Bluegrass Jam Along. Handmade in Austin, Texas, every Collings guitar and mandolin that leaves the shop is built from the sound up, and the team loves seeing a Collings in the hands of players of all levels, from local musicians to world-renowned pickers. Visit collingsguitars.com for more. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of Roots Music Instruction. With 65 streaming video courses for guitar, mandolin, banjo, fiddle, dobro, bass and ukulele from some of the leading names in acoustic music, Peghead Nation is something for every picker. You'll learn the tunes and techniques you need to join in at jams and play the music you love, plus advanced techniques like improvisation, theory and ear training. Your first course is just $20 per month and you can add more for $10 a month. Sign up for any course and get your first month free with the promo code JAMALONG, all one word. Join thousands of other players, including me, who are advancing on their instruments and having more fun playing the roots music they love at pegheadnation.com. Yeah, it's incredible. It's a really, it's one of the coolest things I think about the whole sort of bluegrass string band scene is just how willing people are to encourage kids. You know, because 2 or 3 hours of hanging around with an 11-year-old boy just before you go to work could be annoying. Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying you were an annoying 11-year-old, but it's like...
I'm sure I was.
But people go out of their way, and we've seen it, you know, just... And it is like happening now with the way people are sort of bringing Wyatt Ellis out to things and giving him opportunities. And it's just... It's a really cool thing, isn't it?
It is, man. It's you know, and yeah, we've seen it a lot of times where it's like there's been, you know, and around the same time that I was growing up, I mean, I think I'm a year older than Sierra. You know, we were kind of around the same time, you know, coming out and picking, and Ryan Holiday was around that same age then, and a lot of kids that were kind of my age, that were coming up at the same sort of time. It was just fun to see him because everybody had a similar experience. You know, we all got to meet our heroes. You know, I know Sierra with Allison and you know, me with Earl, and like we all got to meet them and they were all great. And I'm sure that doesn't happen in every kind of music, you know. There are a lot of kids that grow up loving, you know, all kinds of music that may get severely disappointed when they meet their heroes. But I haven't heard many stories of people in this music getting to meet their heroes and being too disappointed. You know, it's all, everybody's just really encouraging. And, yeah, there's something special about this music. And I just think about Earl, because I mean, you know, it's like, this is a guy that helped invent this whole thing. You know, it's like, it's the whole reason we're all doing this. I'm sure he was sick of it, but I was around him so much, and he never, you know, denied anybody the opportunity to come up and get their banjo head signed, or, you know, or just talk to him. Everybody just wanted to talk to him, and he was always nice to everybody. And, you know, that says more than anything, really.
Yeah, there's lots of people who've made admirable music that you might feel let down if you meet. And just there's so many people that are, you know, aren't that approachable just because of the structures they have around them and the way the world needs to work. You know, if you're a Radiohead fan, you're not going to get to hang out with Tommy York and Johnny Greenwood. But
yeah,
if you're a bluegrass fan, chances are you go to a festival, you go to a show, you're going to get to talk to somebody at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a cool scene. And it always kind of has been, you know. You think about, you know, Ricky was on the Flat and Scruggs show when he was 5 or 6, and Marty playing with Earl, or Marty playing with Lester, you know, when he was 13. And you know, there's a lot of those same stories.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a cool sort of parallel with jazz in that way. And that, you know, you sort of read through the history of Miles Davis in the 50s and 60s and the amount of people who came through that band at some point, like the amount of people who came through the Bluegrass Boys or played with Flat and Scruggs, or just the amount of people who got their start in somebody else's band in this world. It's it's one of its strengths, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities there, I think, for sure. My favorite, or not my favorite, but one of my favorite stories was the first time getting to go to Earl's house. And yeah, I talk about that album cover for the that Flat and Scruggs Carter Family record. And that painting, just how many times I had that record. I got the vinyl version and the CD version somewhere. I've got the cassette of it. And, but I love that album cover so much. And if you ever went into Earl's house, as soon as you go into the living room, that painting of Earl was hanging in the living room. And it's, you know, it was probably not their most popular record, I'm sure. It's kind of an odd record if you listen to it now, because it's, there's some interesting choices where, like, the entire record's kind of just coded, and I don't know if it's reverb or delay. It's an interesting choice, because it's not just a little bit, it's a lot, and it's on the whole record. But it's cool. You know, it was the only Flat and Scruggs record that I've heard that had that amount of whatever it was on it. But, you know, it was just interesting that it's so, I don't know really what the way to describe it, but it felt just, you know, to walk into Earl's living room and see that painting on the wall is like, I've been waiting to be here, you know, and to see that. And I've somewhere in a box, I've got a picture of me and Earl next to that. And there was a couple times I went over to his house and got to hang out. And once in particular, he was just really in a great story mood. And he brought out the Flint Hill Special and the Earl Scruggs tuners that were mounted to just a piece of plywood. You know, it was just a little small piece of plywood that had four banjo tuners on it, and you could turn the tuners. You know, you could set the little locks on them and turn. And that was cool. You know, and getting to play his guitar, you know, several times. That I guess it's the one that's at Gruen's now. But yeah, and that's another thing that Earl does that I got from him was his method of protecting your instrument was to carve your name in the headstock. And so if you look at the picture of the guitar that he's got it at Gruen's, it's got Earl Scruggs written in the back of the headstock. And so I've got a couple of guitars, not all of them, but a couple that I know are never going anywhere that I'll scratch my name in as a little. And I think about Earl every time, you know, because it's that was the first thing I noticed whenever I played his guitar at the Opry that night was, you know, he had carved his name in the headstock. And I asked him about it. And he said, yeah, nobody's gonna steal it. If they do, what are you going to do, chop the headstock off?
It's cheaper than having it inlaid all the way down the fretboard like some people do.
Yeah, that's right. You could do both.
And that was Trey Hensley. Always good to have an excuse to talk to Trey again. Next up, we've got Kyle Tuttle. And as I mentioned before, I've got a bigger interview with Kyle coming out in a couple of weeks. But this bit is specifically about Earl Scruggs. And I was just really interested when I saw the press materials that came out for Kyle's record. He sort of said no album would be complete without a nod to Earl Scruggs on it. And his album features a version of Groundspeed that's kind of pretty experimental. It's all electric banjo through a tube amp, and it's brilliant. But I wanted to take this opportunity to chat to Kyle about Earl, and that is what you're going to hear next.
Yeah, he's, I mean, you know, as we all know, like, he wrote the book literally and figuratively, you know, with, and the sort of the more, if you're going to play the 5-string banjo with 3 finger picks on, the more whatever you choose to do is informed by Earl's sound, the easier it's going to be for people to digest for some reason, and the better it's going to sound, the more the world is going to like it, you know, because we love Earl. Everyone loves Earl and that sound and that version of timing, you know? But also but the way that it's recorded on my record obviously is, not a traditional way that you're going to hear it played with the electric banjo and the fuzz bass and stuff like that. But I find a little bit of, the freedom maybe in not trying to exactly follow the rules, to the tradition, the way that people, the way that tradition is, such a big part of this thing. And I can't sound quite like Earl. Maybe the real deal is if I sounded a little more like Earl, I'd be happy to play it like him, you know, with that lineup or something. But yeah, everybody wants to sound like Earl, man. I mean, he's just the best. And what he was doing too was out of the box. Nobody had played that before. Nobody had played some of those, you know, he was hearing some of those horn lines and jazz ideas and getting some of that stuff onto the banjo, which nobody had done that before. But then also you got him coming along with Bill, and like the band essentially had been the same with different styles of banjo. You know, you had String Bean and Grandpa Jones or whatever, and these dudes. And then, here comes Earl plugged into that. And it's like, the whole thing is just like, there's your package. You know, you've been, he was innovative on multiple levels, you know? And then of course in much later years, when he goes and has the Earl Scruggs review with his sons, you know, there's another round of innovation coming from Earl, where he's out there with the electric bass and the banjo and I mean the electric bass and drums and the electric guitars and stuff, you know. I mean there's many sides to Earl for sure.
And it sounds, I talked to John McEwen last year about Doc Watson, and he was talking about the Will the Circle Be Unbroken sessions and what a major part of that Earl was and how he just got what they were trying to do. There was no sense of you know, he went, that's a great idea. How can I help you get other people involved with that? Who do you want me to call, essentially?
Right. Yeah. He recognized the value in doing something like that, or if not even recognize the value, just didn't see any good reason not to do it, you know, which is maybe even more important, you know, because a lot of those old timers on that record, you know, might have needed some convincing to go do a session with a bunch of long haired hippies. But if Earl calls and says do it, then you're probably going to do it, you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? There's two responses to some questions, and one of them is why, and the other one's why not, and that, you know, can take you in totally different directions.
Totally, totally, and they take you in very different directions. Yeah, I know. Why not is such a better in most cases such a better option, you know. But
yeah, and so you've studied banjo pretty intensively at college and also with like various teachers and players. And is Earl like a thread through it? Like, is it possible to learn the banjo without people teaching you some Scrugg style? Is that still the starting point for everything?
I don't think it would really be possible. I mean, it certainly wouldn't be possible to comprehensively learn the banjo without learning Scrugg style, because that's a major part. It's not the only way to play it. There are other ways, but even the other ways are like got to be subtly informed by Earl in some way or another. You know what I mean? Because you can play clawhammer, which for anybody that isn't familiar with it, it's hard a thing to describe. We're just talking about it, no seeing it, but it's more of a strum. It's more of like a down strum thing with your fingers and like a pluck with your thumb. And it's just you would call it maybe a two stroke motion. There's two activities that can happen, you know, and then Earl comes along and he's got the three fingers. So there's three activities that can happen. And there's just, yeah. What do you, I mean, there's two finger, you can play two finger style. Snuffy Jenkins played stuff like that. And String Bean, but you can't, there's no way you could comprehensively study the banjo without studying what Earl Scruggs had done, because guys like Bela Fleck and Tony Trischka have Earl all in their stuff, you know, and these are guys who have broken barriers and created whole new areas of playing the banjo. But Earl's techniques are basically what made that possible, I guess you could even say.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? Just how sort of constant that influence is. You know, it's, I can't, the, one of the things that's emerged from doing these conversations about Earl is just, it seems to be almost a unique thing that your job as a banjo player is basically to recreate what somebody did 70 years ago. And that's not quite the same on any other instrument I can think of.
No, and he's got to be, I've had this thought before, he's got to be one of the most imitated people, musicians on the planet, you know, because they're, like you said, no other instrument is so defined by one guy. I mean, yeah, there's a million people that try and play like Jimi Hendrix. There's a million people that try and play like Jimmy Page, you know, or Stevie Ray Vaughan or whatever. And there's all these cats, and there's a lot of guitar players, but man, there's a lot of cats that they try and do. But Earl is just the one that we all, you know, and even you can even be like, oh, well, he's trying to play like J.D. Crowe or something. It's like, yeah, but he's trying to play like Earl. So there's there, you know, even if you're trying to play like Bela, you know, I mean, there's so much, like I said, so much of what Bela does is informed by and using the techniques created by Earl that you are inevitably also still trying to play like Earl to some degree. So he's got to be one of the most imitated one of the most imitated human beings like to ever live, you know, which I think is super cool.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary thing, isn't it?
And it's all, and like you said, you know, yeah, it's like, oh, wow. Well, we're trying to recreate almost everyone. Our job in a big way is just to recreate this thing this guy did, you know, 70 or a little, yeah. So 70 years ago or whatever, you know, a little bit more ago. But again, like, that's a long time in our lives and stuff. But man, in the span of music, the banjo is like brand new. You know, the piano, the way people shred on the piano has essentially been around for a long time. The way people shred on the violin, the techniques they use, the timing, you know, I'm not saying no one's created anything new on those instruments. Don't get me wrong. But the fundamentals were put in place much longer ago than the fundamentals that we're using to play the banjo. It's like brand new. That's like so exciting. And, you know, to me anyway.
That was Carl Tuttle. Next up is a chat I had with Willow Osborne. I saw Willow play at IBMA in a little room. It was her and Jesse playing together, just two banjos. And so I was blown away by sort of their experimentation, just their sort of fearlessness and the fun in their playing. And so I went up and had a chat with her and said, look, I've got this Earl Scruggs thing planned, can I give you a shout near the time and we'll have a chat about it? And she very kindly said yes. So here's a conversation with Willow Osborne, just about the influence Earl has had on her, but how important he still is to younger banjo players, and some of the kids coming through now. And this was a really interesting conversation. I really enjoyed this one. Here is Willow Osborne.
So I started playing when I was four. I saw somebody named Gary Biscuit Davis play when I was three, and that was just it for me. You know, I was reading about whenever Bela first heard The Ballad of Jed Clampett, and he was five, and he said that he stood there breathlessly, just captivated by this banjo playing. And so I kind of felt the same listening to the man who went on to become my teacher, when I was three, you know, and the first song I learned was Cripple Creek, of course. And that was from Earl's recording. So you could say for sure that Earl has been there since the beginning of my journey. And I can remember just being probably 8 or 9 and listening to just Earl playing like a G run and, you know, playing hammer-ons and pull-offs and thinking, how can I sound like this? How can my hammer-ons and pull-offs and G runs sound exactly like this? I mean, they never will sound exactly like it, right? But, you know, I think Earl is the banjo player that everybody tries to imitate, and what a huge compliment that is.
And especially all these years later, it's, you know, some of those recordings are from the mid-1940s and they're still, like, you know, still the gold standard for people to aspire to in terms of tone and timing and technique and everything.
Absolutely. Earl is, you know, he was 100% solid, you know, in everything that he was doing, whether it was, you know, a really slow, beautiful waltz, you know, or something fast like Ground Speed, or something, you know, a little funky like Foggy Mountain Special. You know, he was just always right on the mark. You know, nobody could just always get it right. You know, like Earl, like with traditional bluegrass banjo playing, it was just Earl really made the blueprint.
It's amazing you sort of talk about always getting it right. And those, like, back recording when they were cutting stuff straight to discs and you couldn't, you know, you didn't have the luxury of 15 takes and just, you know, see how it goes. You had to be able to get it clean and get it quickly just for the sake of everybody else as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think Earl, just something inside of him knew all the right things to be able to just get it right immediately. You know, like the Scruggs style was just always in him. And, you know, I think that I heard, now correct me if I'm wrong, but that he was in his room playing Reuben, the song Reuben, and he realized that he was playing with three fingers instead of two. And he was just, you know, ecstatic and, you know, unbelievably excited. Look what I've done. And so I think the Scruggs style was always within him. You know, he was always supposed to do that. And so it was, I wouldn't say easier for him to improvise, all of these amazing breaks on those one take songs that you're talking about. But I think he just always had that somewhere inside of his heart and his mind that he was just able to pull it out. And like, this is the thing I need to play.
I think that's the thing is with any like great musician, you talk about them and it's their bunch of choices and their ideas and their searching for that sound that's in their head they're trying to get out that makes them. And the rest of us can try and emulate that, but it's still always going to be their thing. And there's only ever one person can have that sound.
Right. Yeah. You know, Jesse and I, a lot of the time we talk about, you know, less of like, how do these people do what they do? Because, you know, like listening to Earl and Bela and Gnome and Allison and Tony and so many other amazing banjo players, listening to them improvise, it's just unbelievable. Like, how do you think of that? Even if you have a bunch of time, but how do you think of that on the spot? And so, you know, kind of the next layer of that, Jesse and I always like to think, what do they practice to be able to improvise like that? You know, because really it is about sitting at home and having this idea of, you know, okay, well, a lot of the time, you know, Bela moves up in, you know, sixths. So I'm going to sit here and I'm going to practice, you know, moving around the neck in sixths. And then maybe the next time I jam it with somebody, maybe that'll come out and I'm improvising, and I hope so. And then, you know, you can maybe take a small step towards sounding a little bit more like your heroes and like you want to be.
And I guess that's how it works, isn't it? You take all of that and you put it in and something else ends up inevitably coming out, and that's you.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of pressure to always sound the best that you're going to sound. Like, every break needs to be your life's work, you know, because there's so many amazing, just unbelievably talented musicians now. And with, you know, things like social media, it's so easy to access all of their amazing music. And it's easy to put the pressure on yourself of saying, man, you know, I need to already be the best that I'm ever going to be. And that's just simply not true for anybody, because anybody, when they're improvising, they are playing exactly how they're supposed to sound. They are sounding exactly the way that they're supposed to sound in that moment, because that's real. That's what's coming from their heart. And a lot of the time, you know, I have to still remind myself, because growing up, I've had this pressure of like, oh, every break I need to play, it needs to be jam packed full of, you know, awesome, chromatic licks or melodic runs or all these things. And I kind of had to say, you know what? I just need to listen to myself and listen and say, what do I want to sound like this break? It doesn't need to be the coolest break, the flashiest break. It just needs to be however I'm feeling in this moment. And I think that, you know, you listen to so many of these amazing banjo players, and it's just coming out of their heart. You know, you can really feel it when they're playing something straight from their heart.
And it's just sort of astonishing that so many of those breaks that Earl took on, like, those early recordings are still what you hear in your head when you hear those tunes. Like, you know, some of the Bill Monroe stuff, like Heavy Traffic Ahead or whatever, you hear that. It's hard to hear that song without that break in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so interesting. We did the Jack Hatfield's banjo workshop last year at Spigma, and Gnome was there, and wow, it was such an unbelievable honor to just get to hear Gnome talk, and we got to jam a little bit with him, which one of the songs we played was Foggy Mountain Special. so anyways, you know, Gnome's talking, and everybody regards Gnome, obviously, as a very progressive banjo player. He's, you know, definitely one of my favorites. And so everybody kind of has this thought in their head, maybe, that like someone who is a progressive banjo player might not like Earl Scruggs because, you know, he's viewed as a traditional banjo player. But Noam sat there and I don't even remember what he was talking about, but he said, you know, Earl Scruggs is my favorite banjo player. And I just thought, how awesome is that? You know, and he said, it is one of the hardest things to do to be able to try and emulate what he did for all those years. And, you know, you start looking at the Scruggs style and it's so incredibly complex. You know, you might think, okay, well, it's a G run here. And, you know, like kind of what we were talking about earlier, hammer on and pull off. But when you start getting into it and looking at, you know, the context of what he's playing with the rest of the music, it's just unbelievable. And it's like an onion. You keep peeling the layers back. You keep finding things. And you know, even in just his backup, it's just, he was just incredibly smart in so many of his decisions. And just, you know, once again, he played what the song really needed.
Yeah, when I spoke to Kristen Scott Benson, she was talking about that and saying that even when he's playing backup sort of up the neck and it's, you know, there's some quite a bit going on, it never gets in the way.
No, you know, and as a banjo player, that's kind of an easy thing to do. You know, you can kind of walk up to a jam and you know, if there's one or two of you, it's, you know, you can kind of, not on purpose, but you know, you can kind of dominate the sound of a jam because banjos are just loud. You know, you can't, sometimes you can't help it, but to be loud. So it's just, you know, it's all about really, you know, finding the right spots to put in this little lick and just kind of looking at the song as a whole. Cause you know, when you're playing, you can definitely get caught up in, you know, the pursuit of awesomeness, I guess, of saying, oh man, you know, I'm going to keep this chromatic run going up and up and up and up. But sometimes, you know, I have to look back and I'm like, Willow, we just need to like take a deep breath and look at how this song is sounding as a whole. Because even though what I'm doing might be cool to me, it might sound cool to me, it's not really what the song is calling for at this moment. And I think Earl just, you know, man, he just always had it. He always had the perfect thing to play. And I think, you know, players like J.D. Crowe, you know, took a lot from his backup. Cause, you know, Crowe and Earl Scruggs had a lot in common with their backup styles. And I think that Crowe probably learned a lot from Earl Scruggs.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine a sort of three finger banjo player not having learned a lot, whether it's direct or through other sources, or, you know, it's still basically the blueprint of what you expect a banjo to sound like in string band music, mm-hmm. of a certain kind, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I was in the house band for a show last year, and it was really fantastic. They had a jam, Junior Appalachian Musicians band, come on and play the pre-show for every show. And I saw so many young, talented banjo players that it was just mind-blowing. Like, they were playing stuff that I'd like to be able to play now, you know, and they're like seven. Like, how did you do that? And I'm like, oh, you just do this, you know? And I would ask him, you know, at some point in the green room, I'd say, oh, who, you know, who's your favorite person to listen to? Who's your favorite banjo player? And, you know, almost every time, every single person said, Earl Scruggs, you know? And it was just kind of like, that was the immediate answer of every person. And then, you know, they might go on to say, and then, you know, Tony Trischka and Bela Fleck and Noam, you know, and Allison and J.D. Crowe and all these fantastic banjo players. But every person immediately, like, their first reaction was Earl Scruggs.
And it's hard to imagine in kind of rock music or pop music, like talking to a kid who's under 10 and saying, you know, who's your influence, and them even knowing who somebody who's around in the 40s was. But, you know, in bluegrass or folk or jazz or whatever, it's that those influences are still so strong.
Absolutely. you know, and there's something that's so warm and just nostalgic about, you know, sitting down at night with a nice cup of tea or whatever you may, and going on YouTube and looking at all these old recordings of, you know, Flat and Scruggs playing different shows, and you know, they're in their suits and they just look so happy, you know, and they just obviously sound amazing, but it just makes you so happy to, or it makes me so happy at least to be able to sit and just watch those recordings.
Yeah, there's something about that sort of period in the 40s and 50s through to the 60s where like recording technology came on leaps and bounds and the record industry was taking off and stuff was starting to be filmed, and it's hard not to think of it as a real golden age in the sort of, particularly in the history of American music, whether it's string band music or whether it's jazz or whether it's swing or whatever. There's so much musical kind of gold in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think like we were talking about earlier, so many of those recordings have just become, you know, what you listen to when you're especially starting playing banjo. You know, whenever I would teach a lot, I would, you know, give a list of songs and banjo players to listen to for people that are just getting into bluegrass and banjo. Obviously, just about every recorded Flat and Scruggs song, you know, I sent so that they could listen to, because, you know, every person when I'm talking to them, you know, oh, well, what do you kind of want to sound like, you know, and they don't know, they might not know Earl Scruggs' name yet, you know, if they're just starting out playing music, but they're like, I want to sound like, you know, that Beverly Hillbilly song. And it's like, yeah, okay, you know, yeah. We can do that. And you know, it's just amazing too how, you know, I always think that the banjo is like this huge thing, because, you know, to me it's, you know, basically my whole life, right? You know, I've played, I can't remember when I didn't play, and you know, we play a bunch of gigs here in Pigeon Forge where people, you know, they know bluegrass music a little bit. They know what comes on the radio, you know, they're more of like country fans and pop fans. And so it's so funny to me because I forget that not everybody is obsessed with banjos like me. And so, you know, they'll come up and they always know Foggy Mountain Breakdown and The Ballad of Jed. You know, they're like, can you play Foggy Mountain Breakdown? And so Earl kind of made this, you know, kind of like this small, you know, in the grand scheme of everything, instrument. And he took it way out into the stratosphere for people, where, you know, even if they don't know anything about banjo or bluegrass, they know Foggy Mountain Breakdown, you know, and that can be kind of a bridge for them to start learning other tunes. You know, you look it up on YouTube and then you get another suggested Earl video, and then you get, you know, Gnome, and then you get, you know, I don't know, Billy Strings, and then you're, you know, you're at your 50th bluegrass festival and you're like, how did this happen?
Yeah, it's really interesting that it feels like with most of the other instruments in a bluegrass band, like the guitar players might go back and stop at Tony Rice or Doc Watson. The mandolin player might stop at Chris Thiele or maybe Sam Bush or Mike Marshall. But like the banjo players are always going to make it back to Earl Scruggs. Like it's just, you know, you go straight back to that first generation.
Absolutely. You know, I was just such a big fan. You know, obviously I still am, but when Earl was alive, you know, it was just, I had the t-shirts. I'm sure I still do somewhere, maybe under my bed. But I probably need to get a bigger size now. But you know, I had the t-shirts, and I vividly can remember the day that Earl passed away. I was at Country Tonight, and it was a theater I performed at when I was younger, and I, you know, went into my dressing room and my mom said, Willow, you know, I gotta tell you something. And she told me, and I just remember like walking onto the wings of the stage and just sitting there. And I was 12 and I was just sobbing, you know, like I was just crying my eyes out. And, you know, it's really fair, because, you know, my life was impacted so much by him, but really you would have thought that, you know, like somebody in my immediate family passed away. I mean, I was just so upset and I never had the opportunity, unfortunately, to meet Earl. But I was just, oh, I was distraught, you know, and Larry, the steel guitar player, was trying to come for me. He also played banjo. He's like, it's okay, Willow, you know, and I just, nothing could help me in that moment. I barely made it through that show, you know.
It's such an extraordinary thing to have had that effect on, like, you know, all the people I'm talking to for this, you know, Earl is a founding pillar of their life. And that will be true for countless other people. And to be able to do that, you know, people you've never met, and to profoundly affect somebody just by playing music and being yourself. And, you know, it's an extraordinary legacy. And it's so cool to have this 100th birthday as an opportunity to celebrate it. And like maybe for a bunch of other people to discover it and find their path through it and pull on those strings, kind of go back through time and find the music and, you know, end up at their 50th bluegrass festival.
Yeah. You know, there's a banjo player now who I'm sure that, you know of, Lincoln Hensley. Do you know him? You know, I absolutely just love listening to Lincoln because he just, you know, I follow him on Instagram and I know him a little bit, but he just takes such care in listening to Flatten Scruggs, listening to Earl Scruggs, and he just knows so much about Earl Scruggs. And whenever I listen to him play, I can hear how many hours he spent listening, and I can hear how much love and, you know, just admiration that he has for Earl. And I went to the Tennessee Bluegrass Band's showcase at IBMA, and I was unable to speak to anyone while they were playing because I was just blown away by Lincoln's playing. And I think, you know, he's one of the best ones out there right now who is really carrying on, you know, the Scrugg style. He's doing a fantastic job.
Well, there's a cool tip for people to go and check out if they don't know Lincoln.
Yeah, absolutely. And he, you know, he does a lot in the world of you know, instrument building and selling, and so, you know, if you get on his Facebook, there's always some good things to look at. They're expensive, but they're sure fun to look at. But you know, I've talked so much about Earl being a traditional banjo player, but honestly, you know, the more you listen to him, the more you realize that he is quite, you know, progressive as well. I always like to bring up the fact that he played a song, you know, and he had Sting on it. He had Sting sing. Have you listened to that?
No.
It's called Fill Her Up. And it's about being in a desert, I think, and you're at this gas station and you work there, and like you decide that you're going to take some money from the cash register and go crazy. I don't know, but it's just so amazing because, you know, you have, you know, people saying, oh, Earl was just so traditional. And it's like, well, okay, but he had Sting, you know, he and Sting played on a song together. I mean, come on.
And you so forget cool. that, like, you listen to like Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs now, because that is the blueprint. There is that sort of tradition about it, but it was radical at the time. You know, nobody had made sounds like that before.
Yes,
and you
exactly.
Don't, you don't sort of do something that progressive and then completely stop being curious.
100%. You know, I mean, that's why Flatten Scruggs broke up, because Earl wanted to to kind of venture out into doing more things. And, you know, Lester was just not a fan of that. And Earl, I forget exactly what he said, but he said something like, you know, if I can't add a few, this is me way paraphrasing, but if I can't do, you know, some of these crazy tunes, I'm going to, you know, become depressed. And I do know that he actually did say depressed, you know, like he wanted to do some other things as well, just to keep his creative side. I mean, you don't come up with all of these songs that are standards, by not being creative and not doing something at that time that was just unheard of.
That was Well I Was Born, and that is it for episode 3. And there is one more episode coming of this Earl Scruggs tribute, because I had the opportunity to talk to Jim Mills. Jim, longtime member of Ricky Skaggs' band Kentucky Thunder, you know, just a master at that Scruggs style, driving banjo playing, master of that style, but also knows a lot about pre-war Gibson banjos. And I wanted to ask him a bit about that as well, because I think that's a really interesting part of the story. And part of Earl's legacy is sort of the banjos people play now, based on what Earl played. So that will be there. Possibly another interview to add to that, but I'm not sure at this point. But yeah, one more at least to come from Jim Mills, and then maybe we will move on and talk about something that isn't Earl Scruggs for a while. But I've really enjoyed doing these. They're a lot of fun. They're really interesting. I've learned so much, and I hope you've enjoyed them too. That is it for this week. I'll see you next time. Happy picking. Bluegrass Jamalong is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, making some of the finest guitars and mandolins in the world since the 1970s. Visit collingsguitars.com and find out why.